Okay, we're on the record. The House Resources Committee is called to order at 1:04 p.m. on Monday, February 13th, 2023. We are meeting in Capitol Room 124. Present are Representative Sadler, Representative Rauscher, Representative Dibert, Representative Armstrong, Representative Mears, and Chairman Tom McKay. We may have Representative Puck-Tuck joining us shortly. I see no legislators in the audience. Let the record, Representative McCabe is excused today, as is Representative Wright. Okay. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to do business. I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Justin, and our moderator, Sydney, for helping keep everything in order today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. Okay, moving ahead. Today we have the Department of Environmental Conservation here to talk to us about 404 permits and the state's effort to take over the process from the federal government. Commissioner Bruni is with us today, accompanied by Julie Pack and Shannon Miller. Thank you for joining us today, and welcome to House Resources. Commissioner Bruni, please put yourself on the record and offer your opening remarks. Ms. Pack and Ms. Shannon, please state your name for the record and begin your presentation after Commissioner Bruni. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Bruni. I am the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and it's an honor to be here today to talk about this incredibly important issue. So what we're going to be talking about today is a budget request that will be within the governor's amended budget that will be coming out on Wednesday. And I'm going to give a little background, obviously. So the 404 program is the dredge and fill program. As you'll hear both Julie and Shannon talk about later, no one has more wetlands than the state of Alaska does. We have 175 million acres of wetlands in our state, and they provide incredibly important ecological functions. They also obviously are things that are impacted when development projects occur. So we want to make sure that this program that we're proposing, that the legislature gave us the authority to pursue primacy over back in 2013, is a program that obviously the legislature continues to support, and that we work collaboratively with the legislature to make sure it's put in place in an appropriate manner. I want to start a little bit of background about what primacy programs are. So Congress passes bills like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act. And under the federalism approach, states have the opportunity to take on those programs because of the expertise that they possess to be able to manage them. So DEC was founded 51 years ago, right after the EPA was formed. And one of the first programs that we took on was the Clean Air Act oversight, Clean Air Act primacy. And that bill had been passed by Congress around that time, 1968, I believe, or somewhere around that time, and we became an agency back in 1971, and we took over that program. With that taking over, we were given funding by the federal government as well as the state government to be able to oversee that program. Soon thereafter, we did the same thing with the Safe Drinking Water Act, the middle of the 70s. That's, of course, is any drinking water system over 25 people has to make sure that the water that the people are drinking is safe. And, of course, again, the expertise that the state of Alaska has and that the regulators within the state of Alaska have is way better to oversee a program than someone that's in Seattle or someone in Washington, D.C. In the mid-2000s, a number of you, or some of you were legislators at the time, we put forward a proposal for the NPDES program. That's the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, also known as Section 402 of the Clean Water Act. That regulates the discharge of wastewater. We did that in a tiered approach for 4 years. We took on the program, and right now we have full assumption, full primacy over the NPDES program. Finally, this past year, the state became the 49th state to work to assume primacy of the RCRA program, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. That's the handling of solid waste. We were appropriated dollars by the legislature this past year. We hired the entire staff that's putting the application together, and by July 1st of 2024, the intention is that we'll have approval from the EPA to take on that program. So what's next? What's next is obviously what we're here today to talk about, and that's the Clean Water Act Section 404, which regulates the discharge of dredge and fill material. Obviously incredibly important, and back in 2013, the legislature gave us that authority to pursue that. Next slide, please. So in 2013, the bill that was passed was SB 27, and the legislature mandated DEC to shall take reasonable steps to assume primacy of the 404 program. That was the directive, and as many of you have heard me say, we can do no more and no less than what the legislature gives us the authority to do. So each of you or your predecessors gave us that authority from very, very resounding majorities, 15-2 in the Senate and 25-13 in the House, to pursue this assumption of this program. And so now I'm going to turn it over to Julie Pack to talk about the legal background about what our goal is today. So, Julie.
Thank you, Commissioner Bruni. Thank you, representatives, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record. My name is Julie Peck. I'm an Assistant Attorney General here representing the Department of Law. Before getting into the legal landscape, just a quick note on how EPA's 404C veto power applies. EPA's statutory 404C power will be unaffected by state assumption of the 404 program. We just wanted to note that because we know that's on a lot of people's minds at this moment.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Ms. Pack, I just clarified that veto power, is that the power that EPA exercised in the case of the Pebble Mine?
That is the power that I'm referring to. Yes, Representative.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as Commissioner Bruni briefly touched upon, the Clean Water Act Section 404 program regulates the discharge of dredge or fill material into what's called waters of the United States. What this means on the ground is projects involving construction, site improvement, building roads, resource development projects, building houses, if they discharge into waters of the United States. Thank you. If they discharge into waters of the United States, then a 404 permit is required. Which means that in order to understand the 404 permitting program, we have to take a step back and understand waters of the United States and the scope of that term. So the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972. It's a historic and monumental piece of legislation, and the scope of it is defined by the term navigable waters. So the Clean Water Act applies to navigable waters. Navigable waters is further defined as waters of the United States, including the territorial seas. Now, this definition, waters of the United States, which is technically a definition of the term navigable waters, this definition is highly controversial. From 2015 to 2020 to 2023, and potentially any day now with a case that's currently before the United States Supreme Court, this definition has changed and changed and changed. And right now, it is currently at its most expansive. And this is under the 2023 Biden rule that was recently finalized in January of this year and will take effect in March 20th of this year. One specific subsection of Section 404G, expressly provides that the state expressly allows the state to take over administration of this program over certain waters. And this was Congress's intent, as reflected in 404G itself, as well as reflected in Section 101B of the Clean Water Act, which states that it is Congress's intent that states retain the primary authority over water and land use decisions happening within the boundaries of their state. And so we really want to remind everyone that this was Congress's intent all along, and we are fulfilling Congress's objective here with you all. So there is a question of how much of this program does the state get to assume? 404G contains the language that is our starting point for how much waters the state gets to.
Ms. Pat, can I, you're doing great. I got to slow you down just a little bit.
Of course. Apologies, Mr.
At 1:14 p.m., we've been joined by Representative Pakatuk. And let's pause at the end of each slide for questions just for a moment, okay?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
And we have one right now, Rev. Sadler.
Thank you for the opening, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Ms. Pack, what is at issue, going back to slide number 7, please, I've been following the WOTUS issue for a long time. And I understand that under this administration, it is the most expansive definition of waters in the United States. What is that issue? What are the ramifications of how Sackett versus EPA are decided any day now?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. The issue in Sackett v. EPA is what is the definition of WOTUS as it applies to wetlands? That's the issue posed before the court. Sometimes the court doesn't answer directly the issue that's before it, but that's the issue before the court. In the case before the court, the facts are a residential lot that the Sacketts, a couple, wanted to develop. And they didn't think they needed a 404 permit because they didn't think that their property discharged into waters of the United States. EPA disagreed, and long story short, they are now at the Supreme Court litigating over the question of whether they need a 404 permit, which turns on the question of whether their property is a waters of the United States.
Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative, did that fully answer your question?
It did, if I could follow, but if you could expand on what happens if the expansive definition of the waters of the United States is retained or even expanded. What are the implications for Alaska?
The implications for Alaska are, if you look on slide 11, this is an approximation of the wetlands in Alaska as delineated by the USGS. Now, a caveat that there are different ways of delineating wetlands, and this isn't necessarily the way that Alaska would endorse, but this gives us an idea of the wetlands in Alaska. And this is important because as WOTUS is currently defined, it's currently defined by the significant nexus test. And the way the significant nexus test is articulated, that would cover most, if not all, of the wetlands in Alaska. And this isn't even talking about the rivers and tributaries and headwaters.
So,
Rep. Sadler again.
Thank you. To follow up on a cap on that a statement. So the implications of the Sackett case is just what the realm that DEC would be assuming primacy over 404 permitting would encompass. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement.
Okay. Rep. Armstrong.
Thank you, through the chair. I just wanted to follow up on slide 8 where it says state will get majority of the wetlands. I feel like I read somewhere it would come around to 75% and then Army Corps would maintain 25%. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative, the feasibility study did use the numbers 75 versus 25%. However, that referred to the actions that the DEC would take over from the Corps. That's not reflective of the scope as far as geographically. Of waters that DEC would take over, that scope is much larger than 75%.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The line between waters that the state will assume and waters that the Corps will retain has historically been a hurdle for states assuming. Alaska would be the fourth state to assume in over 40 years of states being able to assume. The reason is rooted in the text of 404G, which if you look at the slide, it's the bolded language. To skip over every detail, it's not clear where the line between, based on this language alone, it's not clear where the line between waters that the Corps retains and waters that the state assumes is. So to address this confusion, President Obama's EPA in 2015 convened a working group, which produced a report in 2017, which was adopted by the Corps officially in 2018, and as recently as a few weeks ago, reaffirmed by EPA. And this report contains clear indications of where the line will be, or at least the starting point of negotiations of where the line between the Corps retained waters and the state assumed waters will be. And so we now have guidance that we did not have a couple years ago from the federal agencies on this point. And so just for a visual, the drafters of our feasibility study graphed the potential retained waters by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And what we're looking at is Section 10 waters. So Section 10 refers to Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act, which is an act that the Corps has regulatory authority under. And there's a list of, 47 waters that the Corps currently has on that list. And so this memo that I just told you about, this memo says, hey, look at this list And we'll start with the waters on this list plus adjacent wetlands and take off any waters on that list that are on there solely for historical use. And that tracks with the language that I showed you on the screen, that bolded parenthetical. And so this is a visual of waters that the Corps would get to retain, and that shaded area in the middle is Denali National Park. Metlakatla as a reservation is also an area that the state would not assume permitting authority over. And so just to compare, a vast majority of these wetlands, at least under the current WOTUS definition, gives us an approximate representation of land area that the state would have permitting authority over if and when the state assumes the program. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to Program Manager Shannon Miller.
I think Rep. Sadler has a question first.
Thank you. Through the Chair, Ms. Pack, so on slide 10, so I see only the areas that the federal government would retain 404 authority under the Rivers and Harbors Act. Is that solely the crosshatch area around Denali National Park, or is there other area in the state, like southeast, that it would be retained by the federal government?
Through the Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. Each of the blue lines are traced over the rivers and lakes that are currently listed. I apologize for that confusion. So it is that shaded area as well as each of those blue lines, and you'll notice that the entire coast is shaded with that as well as the Rivers and Harbors Act Section 10 waters.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Through the Chair, thank you, Representative.
So if I'm a kind of simple man, you know, Ms. Pack, my impression was that the state of Alaska would get all the waters if we took over primacy. But that's not the case at all, is it? We're just getting a piece of it. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, the Clean Water Act only allows certain waters to be assumed. And to call it a piece of it maybe doesn't take into account how large Alaska is. And perhaps that's why other states haven't had the momentum to take over the program, because you're right, they don't get to take over the entire program. There's that subset of waters that no state gets to take over.
Okay, thank you. Representative Mears.
Through the Chair, we were talking about the state taking over 75% of actions, and this slide that we just had, this slide shows a certain number of waters that will remain in federal hands. So are there certain actions that are also included, or is it just these geographies?
Through the Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. The actions go, so it's the scope of geographic coverage that creates that dividing line. All of the actions that go on either side of that line stay, so it's not divided up based on type of action, it's divided up based on geography, if that answers your question. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Please continue now. Oh, I'm sorry. Rep. Pakta.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, that I missed the first few pages of the presentation, but I just had a few questions in regards to long-term feasibility of taking over primacy. I know Mr. Burney mentioned one of the previous meetings last week, might have been a budget finance subcommittee meeting, where we look at the other states that have taken primacy, Florida being one of them, and the expectations of the burden on the department and what we have to employ, given how long some of these other states have taken over, what are they looking like right now as far as number of employees, et cetera? And this might be more of a finance discussion, but I do have to run here shortly, so I wanted to get a question in. So, can it get away from us? We hire 30 guys to start, guys or gals, whatever, to start. As we start to take, you know, 75% of the authority, and then number of acres as far as wetland management, do we run the risk of having to employ 500 employees, for example?
Yep. Representative Puckettuck, through the Chair, thank you for that question. For the record, Jason Bruni, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. That's something definitely Shannon is going to be getting into specifically, but that was one of the things that we looked at in the feasibility study, and that was, what is the long-term viability of this program and the sustainability of the program in order to make sure, will we have sufficient folks? Is it going to grow? What have previous programs that the state of Alaska has taken on and assumed, how have they grown or not grown? And so the feasibility study looked at that, and we think that the number of positions, 28 to start, growing to 32 next year, is going to be sufficient to be able to oversee the number of activities that are going to be taking place on our wetlands. Yes, we have a lot more wetlands than the other states that have assumed. Obviously, we have more wetlands than the entire lower 48 combined. However, the number of actions, the development that occurs on them, is far less than what you see in New Jersey, Michigan, or Florida. So it requires about 18 actions per employee per year is what the feasibility study looked at. And I think that that's going to be able to be maintained. If indeed it does grow, that's going to be a positive thing because it will be positive economic opportunities in the state, which will then ultimately lead to, obviously, more royalties potentially to the state, more taxes to the state, more development, more jobs that we will happily then come back and ask for additional funding for that, or some of this program, and we're going to be talking about that a little more later as well. Some of it may be funded through fees or through federal appropriations as well. Representative Pakatuk, Shannon is going to be getting into more details on that question later on as well, but I just wanted to give you an early answer to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
For the record, Shannon Miller, Program Manager, Department of Environmental Conservation. So the big question is, why is it important that Alaska takes on this program? Well, because we have approximately 174 million acres. That's about 43% of the state. And to further put that in perspective, that's two-thirds of our nation's wetlands are here in Alaska. It's critical that we protect these wetlands in a way that works for Alaska. The 404 program, as Commissioner Bruni pointed out, was intended to be assumed by states through federal cooperativism. And that means that we'll be working with our federal partners to assume the program in a way that works for the state. Steps towards assumption. This has already been codified in Alaska Statute 4603.020 under 14. It gives us the directive to oversee the administration of this program and to seek assumption. So with Senate Bill 27 in 2013, we had that approval with the Alaska statute. It was codified in statute. But in 2014, due to budget constraints, we had a budget cut. And it's because this program hadn't yet been launched. But we shelved this program in such a way that we would be able to take it off the shelf and pick it up again, which is what we were trying to do last session. At the time, we came to the legislature in 2022 and requested program funding. But at that time, the legislature provided us with $1 million to conduct the feasibility report. So I'm happy to be able to present on that topic. We put out a request for proposal, and in the language of that request for proposal, we asked our consultant to develop a report that identified the benefits and the challenges. We took it a step further. We wanted to be convinced that the challenges could be met, and we wanted that roadmap to get us from A to B, from where we are today to program assumption. This is the feasibility report. We were able to hire Jade North as contractors. Jade North is built up of representatives who have retired from state service. There's a huge brain trust there. We have retired Deputy Commissioner Ed Fogles of DNR, retired Deputy Commissioner Lynn Kent with Department of Environmental Conservation, and we have Bob Loeffler, retired Division Director, DNR, Mining, Land, and Water. And then we also have Victor Ross with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and he spent 30 years with the Army Corps of Engineers. In addition to those individuals, we also hired Baker Botts. Baker Botts is the outside counsel who assisted Florida in their 404 assumption. And Florida just assumed the program in 2020. So what are the benefits of this program? One of the major benefits, especially with Alaska's short construction season, has to do with permit streamlining. We have the real opportunity to take advantage of looking at general permits, making greater use of those general permits. Alaska is very unique, and much of the uniqueness is only found here in this state. So it doesn't make sense to have the federal government overseeing something that only takes place in this state, and they have to account for the entire nation. So we'll be able to capitalize on those general permits. We'll also be able... Question?
Okay. Rep. Sadler?
Thank you, through the chair, Ms. Miller. For those watching at home, describe what a general permit is and why it's beneficial.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative, a general permit is a general type of activity. So that type of activity gets reviewed. And so then if a, say, for example, somebody wants to build a platform and they want to put in gravel and fill the wetland. So that general type of activity has already been reviewed. And so the review process is quicker so that we can look to make sure that all the criteria are set by the applicant and issue the authorization through the general permit.
Follow-up?
So that means instead of having to get each individual pad or project permitted, if you have a general characteristic, you can get one permit to do the same thing several times different places, similar places. Much more efficient.
Through the chair, that is accurate. Obviously, the permittee will still need to apply and ensure that they meet the requirements of that general permit. But, yes, that is accurate.
Okay. Rep. Armstrong.
Thank you, through the chair. Can you give an example of a project where the Army Corps of Engineers is handling it one way, and if we were tailoring it based on our unique conditions, how we might do it differently?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative. One example might be with residential construction. If you have a developer looking at developing a large swath of land, wants to build a neighborhood, if the project impacts wetland unavoidably, then they have to mitigate for that. And so typically, the national standard is the no net loss standard. So typically what is done is there's a requirement to set lands aside. So those lands can't be developed. One of the things that the state is looking at doing is, instead of the no net loss, and we'll get into that in a future slide, is we want to build into this more flexibility. So flexibility being things such as, instead of setting lands aside, we want to identify projects that will benefit the state of Alaska, such as cleaning up orphan contaminated sites or fixing culverts that will allow for better fish passage, things of that nature.
Follow-up?
And just help me understand, have we tried working with the federal government on these more creative solutions, and are they just not open to it or don't have the interest, bandwidth, finances to be more creative with us on this?
Through the chair, Representative. There is a 2018 memorandum of agreement between EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that allows for this flexibility. It's already written into, can I say, law? It's written into the law. It's agreed to in this memo. So the reason that they haven't been implementing the flexibility, I don't know. I can't speak to that. But what I can say is the standard is to set land aside.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Rep. Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. So I have an advantage over lots of folks in here that I've done some work and have done permits as a civil engineer throughout the state. But there's lots of other areas that I haven't had the advantage to work in. Coordination with other project permits. So what divisions or sections within DEC do you anticipate there being other projects and permitting that would get some streamlining and coordination with the 404 primacy?
Through the chair, Representative, the state is accustomed to coordinating with other state agencies and, of course, internally as well. So we have a real opportunity to be able to work with our other state agencies to, especially with larger projects, make sure that our permit timelines line up. We coordinate to ensure that we are meeting the requirements of other state agencies. For example, we want to work with our state historic preservation office to ensure that we have the appropriate stipulations in place so that we can protect our resources, our historic resources there.
Mr. Chair. For the record, Jason Bruni, Commissioner of DEC. Shannon's spot on, but there are other opportunities to coordinate with ourselves. Like the 401 certification process, obviously, is something that we would normally be doing on top of the 404 that the Corps of Engineers is doing. And Shannon's going to get to that in another slide. But working for coordination with the 402 process, the 401 certification process, as well as, when appropriate, the Title 16 or other processes within the state, we will have the opportunity to make sure that through the OPUMP process within DNR that we're talking to each other. There has been times over the course of the last 2 years where the Corps of Engineers has cut off communication with the Department of Environmental Conservation as we're developing and working on these processes. We will be the entity that's accountable. We will be the ones that are talking to ourselves with internal conversations with DEC, talking to Fish and Game, talking to DNR. And I think having that coordination is going to only help in the expediting of the permitting process.
Okay, Rep. Puckaduck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got to be careful starting to get a bunch of questions popping up as we have the discussion. Going back to, I believe what you said about the MOA and working with the Army Corps, I know, you know, going back to one of the foundations that I believe is critical to at least where I come from, maintaining that aspect of local control, and going back to your slide on your picture on number 11 and seeing a bunch of green stuff way up north, what kind of opportunities does it present for first-class home rule governments who retain permitting authority at the municipal level to then, when the state takes primacy, opportunities present themselves for municipalities to take primacy?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative, we can also further streamline permits so that we would develop what's called a regional general permit. So that would work similar to a general permit, but that would be developed and created by the state, and then it would be implemented through the municipalities.
Okay. Yeah, I say that just because in my own personal experience working on my house, gravel placement, drilling pilings is all subject to Army Corps approval, wetland mitigation, etc. I think I applied in like February or March, didn't get it until July when the drilling season's over, obviously. So I think there's opportunity to where this can benefit a lot of the green areas in the state. But having a balanced approach to making sure that when it comes to other things, where you have that local process, that local permitting process is left intact, because what I would be cautioned to is getting a project potentially railroaded down a local area's purview by maybe the rest of the state's interests. So what assurances are there in that regard to making sure that local process and that opportunity for local control is kept intact?
Through the chair, Representative, again, with the regional general permit, that's a umbrella type of authorization permit that gets issued, reviewed through the state. So those activities would be approved, provided that permit applicant meets all the qualifications. And then the municipality would administer that program or that permit. So, for example, with your example of filling your area, that could get approved. The activity itself gets approved by the state, and then you would go to your municipal office, make the request for the permit. The municipal office will review your information. It meets the criteria, and they would sign off on it, and then you get that permit.
Okay. Follow up on a different subject or different idea here. When we go to the carve out of 75% of the authority, is that can we do 74%? Can we do 70%? Or is it take it or leave it, all the above, as far as the authorities that the state would assume?
Through the chair.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Jason Bruni, Commissioner of DEC, Representative Puckaduck, through the chair. We're going to get as close to 100% as we possibly can get. There are just certain requirements in the Rivers and Harbors Act and others that the Corps has to maintain. So 75% was the estimate that the feasibility study put together, but we're going to be pushing for assuming, like I said, as much as we absolutely can. And recognizing, though, that again, federal law prohibits us from taking 100%. There's going to be certain things that they get to maintain, and the rest we're going to take. So 75 was just a wag, but I promise you, assuming the legislature gives us the funding to be able to do this, we will try to have local control of as much of our dredge and fill wetlands as we possibly can have.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
Thank you. One last thing on the slide that I want to address is the state will be able to eliminate the 401 certification. Now, the 401 certification comes from Section 401 of the Clean Water Act. Basically, what that is it is the approval under a – so the Corps issues the 404 permit, and this is the state's 401 duplicative effort to ensure that the 404 activity meets the requirements set out in the state's water quality standards. So under a state assumed program, we wouldn't have to issue those 401 certifications for those waters that have been assumed by the state. We still will issue 401 certifications for those waters that the Corps retains. Another benefit has to do with the flexibility. We talked a little bit about this already, but the flexibility with compensatory mitigation. As I previously mentioned, if a project has unavoidable impacts to wetlands, then they must compensate for that. So again, under a federal run program, the focus has been on no net loss, setting lands aside, which makes sense in the lower 48, but here in Alaska, where we've developed less than 0.1%, it doesn't make as much sense. So again, going back to that creativity of being able to looking at doing better with the water quality, being able to look at these other different types of projects. Another benefit is that we'll be accountable to Alaskans. State government, state agencies, we're closer to the individual Alaskan. So that if an individual Alaskan wants to make comment on a policy that we're working on, we're available to them, as are you. We have state offices throughout the state, and the legislature is available throughout the state. This is much more challenging when you're an individual Alaskan trying to have your voice heard at the national stage. Also, physically, our offices are located where people have easy access, while the Corps' office is located on base.
Okay, Rep. Sadler, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair to Ms. Miller, I'm going to ask a blunt, maybe even ugly question. If the state of Alaska is going to proposing to assume 404 permitting primacy, but we must still do it under federal standards, are we really more accountable to Alaskans in the legislature, as the second point here is? It's kind of that delegation of authority. Do we really have authority, or are we just implementing federal authority? Help understand and explain to people why we're not being that we don't have the power we think we might.
Through the chair, Representative, you are correct. We have to be as stringent as law requires us to be. But we can create policies that allow for, like what we've discussed, permit streamlining, doing things in a different way, such as compensatory mitigation. Currently, the Corps has different policies that are not set in law per se. So, for example, the no net loss, that's a policy. So the Corps has a document that they've drafted which outlines the thought process of how they come up with what applies for compensatory mitigation. And it's a policy set, whereas our policies will be reviewed by the public and by the legislature.
Follow up.
So through the chair, Ms. Miller, so you're saying that the underlying standards, the underlying federal law, we must still comply with, but it's the implementation and some of the policies, we would strip away some of that extra burden and substitute Alaska-based, more simplistic, more enlightened solutions for Alaska. So we would actually have a net gain in terms of our managerial authority. Practically speaking.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Okay, Rep. Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. Very pragmatic question. We were just talking about access. Is this program imagined to be split up against amongst different regional offices? And where will Anchorage folks sit? Is there space at 55 Cordova, or is there other places where they'll be?
Through the chair, Representative, the feasibility study outlines a couple of options. We're looking at one in particular in which there will be offices throughout the state. How that works out is yet to be determined, but we're looking at having it be where the urban hubs are located. With respect to whether the building has capacity at the Anchorage location, maybe Commissioner can speak to that.
For the record, Jason Bruni, Commissioner of DEC, Representative Mears, through the chair, thanks so much for that question. We're actually really excited about the opportunity that DEC staff have had for teleworking. So we've made every position in the state when I took over 4.5 years ago. Every state, every position within DEC can be advertised statewide. So there used to be positions that were focused Juneau only or Anchorage only. And there are certain positions still that you have to have at specific locations. But for the most part, we're able to do that anywhere in the state. We're also able to have folks working from home, focusing on making sure that the job is getting done, the metrics are getting done, not that they're at any specific location. The building in Anchorage can hold around 250 people on any given day. We probably still have around 75% of our folks that telework 2 to 3 days a week, if not more. Some are full-time. And we've really encouraged that. That's helped with our retention. Our retention levels, we used to have about a 25 to 30% annual turnover rate. This past year, we have a 14% turnover rate. Still not great, but during the year of the great resignation, to have cut our turnover rate in half, I'm pretty dang proud of that. And so, yes, there is absolutely space in Anchorage at 555, but the goal, I would say, is to have folks spread out. With all of the fiber that's going to be put around the state with the EJIA bill, we might even have the opportunity to have folks located in rural Alaska where we don't have offices that could help remote projects in their development. So I think the sky's the limit for where we could be putting folks working on this program. But right now, what the feasibility study envisions is having them in our main hubs.
Follow up?
So one of my concerns here is some overarching things that we're seeing as a legislature, and that is folks leaving the state of Alaska and finding folks to work and recruitment and retention. So we're looking at probably in some ways, if it's a direct correlation, 75% of the staff at the Army Corps of Engineers has the expertise and background to run this program for the state. I'm sure there's other folks around. I've got a regulatory background, but I'm sitting here. You know, some other folks with some of that expertise. We're looking to recruit almost 3 dozen people into a state that is not providing competitive salaries, that is not providing a defined benefit program. And we're looking at building an entire program based on that weakness. And that's concerning to me.
Through the chair, Representative Mears, and I'm glad that you bring that up, and it's actually something we have a very exciting good news story that we can tell about the program that we just were given appropriations from the legislature, the RCRA program, for assuming that Shannon actually was leading that effort before we stole her from ourselves to lead this effort. So Shannon, if you could talk a little bit about that, and hopefully, Representative, that addresses your question.
Sure. Shannon Miller, for the record, through the chair. So the RCRA program, we had a couple of recruitments, and actually I misspoke there. We had one recruitment, one person lateraled into the management position. The other position, we went out, did the recruitment, and we needed to hire several positions under that one recruitment. And I'm pleased to say that we had a robust applicant pool. The level of professionalism on the environmental program specialist track is a little bit different perhaps than maybe what other departments are seeing as far as recruitment goes. But we've been very fortunate in receiving very qualified individuals, very qualified applicants. And with the RCRA, with that one recruitment, we were able to hire our entire staff and had to turn away some very qualified individuals.
Okay, Rep. Armstrong.
Is that same pool similar? Thank you, through the chair. Is that same pool of qualified applicants the same types of folks we need to staff this new program so it would transfer over?
Through the chair, Representative, that is correct.
And Mr. Chair, Jason Bruni, Commissioner of DEC, one of the things, Representative Armstrong, that we focused on is in order to give the regulated community timely, science-based, legally defensible permits, we have to ensure that retention of our staff is paramount. When I came in and I saw that annual turnover rate of 3 in 10 folks, you can't do that. You've got to change things. So we've put in training programs in place. We're showing people career paths within DEC. Folks that come to work with DEC, they want to protect human health and the environment, but they also want to be partners with the regulated community. And we've shown them a path to matriculate up within the organization. We're doing 1, 3, and 5 year development plans. What training do you need to become the next director or the next commissioner of DEC if that is your goal? We're putting that training in place, and then amount of work tracking that training, we're funding that training, and I've made all of my directors, that's their number one requirement, is to ensure that we are retaining those staff. So it's been an absolute priority of mine. We've seen significant progress, and we're going to continue putting an emphasis on that as well.
Follow-up.
Thank you, through the chair, putting on my business owner hat and thinking about how I budget and incorporate overhead. The $5 million that you're asking for, does it include and budget for all of the training and supports and just the general overhead that goes into growing this whole program, or is it just covering salary and benefits? And
through the chair, Representative Armstrong, absolutely. I mean, ask any of my directors. That is a number one priority at every spend plan meeting that we have, at every monthly meeting when we discuss it. We have our dashboards. We have our metrics that we're looking at. How much are you spending on training? How much effort is, how many training hours have your staff taken? What is are we showing a growth? Are we showing better retention? All of that is a key emphasis that is built into that budget, and it was a requirement of mine when we put this budget together.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
So another benefit, but also a challenge, will be seen through NEPA and the environmental review process. So in some cases, the state program will not need to conduct the federal NEPA process, but we must be as stringent as the 404B1 guidelines. And the guidelines basically outline the requirements. It evaluates the impacts on the physical, chemical, biological, and human use characteristics of the aquatic environment and special aquatic sites. So it is an environmental review process. In addition to that, the state already incorporates our own processes that we've been doing for years. So we need to ensure that requirements are met on our own state standards. So we can be a little more stringent if we need to be. And, of course, looking at the water quality standards would be one of those. So the other aspect of when we remove the NEPA process, this can save millions of dollars on a project without compromising the environmental review process. And also timeline.
Okay, please continue.
Another challenge is that Julie had talked to the Corps retaining some jurisdictional waters. So we need to ensure that we have MOAs in place, that the standards are set, and that it's very clear to the permittees whose waters that the jurisdiction falls to. This is an example of a river. On either side of the river is a 300-foot administrative boundary. So this 300-foot boundary is just a starting point. Depending on what the needs are of the area, this could be much smaller or it could be a little bit larger. But these are all part of the negotiation process that we will have with the Corps. And we are already in discussions with the Corps talking about assuming this program, and they're very supportive. We're also in discussions with EPA. They're also very supportive of the state taking on this program, and we'll need to develop some MOAs with EPA as well, and potentially the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So this gets to the workload and staffing. So based on the analysis conducted over a five-year period, we determined that the state would assume approximately 75% of the permitting actions that the Corps is currently responsible for. So that would account to 581 actions per year. So with 32 full-time employees, that accounts to about 18 actions per employee per year. So currently, the Corps, with 48 full-time employees, each employee has about 16 actions per year. But the state believes that we can do a little bit more because we're looking at doing general permits and streamlining the permitting process a little bit more. We're looking at a program development cost over 2 years. So basically, this would be a general fund ask. And for the first fiscal year, we're looking at a little over $4.9 million. We'll hire 28 full-time positions and 24. This accounts for training, equipment, travel, legal consultation, regulation development, coordination with other agencies, and developing the assumption application. Again, we'll be working with EPA early and often when we're working to develop that assumption application. So by the time we submit the application, it's been reviewed by them and it'll be considered a complete application. In FY25, we anticipate adding 4 more additional positions, and the budget for that year and moving forward, we're estimating approximately $4.7 million.
Okay, Rep. Armstrong just got her hand up just before Rep. Pierce.
I'd be great at an auction. Thanks, Chair. thank you, Commissioner, for mentioning earlier the differences with why Florida, Michigan, and New Jersey, their programs cost so much more money. I'm curious what you learned looking at Florida. They began with 40 staff, $7 million, and they're currently at 170 staff and 11.8. How confident are we that we won't have to go past $5 million and 32 full-time positions past 2025?
Representative, through the chair. Based on the analysis, we're quite confident, but not knowing what we don't know, we anticipate that this is exactly what is needed. If we have more development in the state, then we will need to hire more employees. But at this point in time, with the information that we have in front of us, we're very confident with this number.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Jason Bruni, Commissioner DEC, Representative Armstrong, through the chair, thank you again for that question. I think one of the reasons we did this feasibility study was to look at what has been the trend with the Corps. So you look at the trend that they've had, the number of actions on an annual basis, and you've seen that on average, 775 actions have been taking place over the course of the last 5 years. Now, on when economic opportunities go up, that number will go up, and it'll go down when things are not going quite as well. So we thought it was best to look at the last 5 years, and that gave us the number of positions we thought we were going to be able to need, especially in that 16 versus 18 activities, given the general permits that we plan on using. There are a lot more activities, like I mentioned, that are occurring just because of their access to infrastructure and people don't generally want to build manufacturing plants or much in Alaska. So there's a lot less activity going on in Alaska. So I think that's why you see so much, especially during COVID, saw so much growth happening in Florida, so many homes needing to be built, so many wetlands needing to be impacted, that the number of employees that they had in Florida just grew exponentially, and they needed that demand was it. We'd love to have that problem. Of course, one of the things we're going to be looking at right now, it's 100% general fund. We're going to be looking at, and in fact, right now, we have 3 states have primacy. Those 3 states and us have talked, along with the Environmental Council of States. Those are my colleagues at other states that are DEC commissioners in the other states. All of the other programs, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, RCRA, they give money from the federal government to help pay for those programs. The 404 program does not. So we're asking ECOS, I've talked to Senator Murkowski and Senator Sullivan, give us a little love. We should get a little federal money just like the other programs that are primacy programs. We're also going to be looking at, during this assumption process and the application process, of potentially implementing user fees. We do that for the other primacy programs as well. We don't know what it's going to be, but we've told the industry, the regulated community, that that is something we will look at. I can tell you from talking to a number of folks in the regulated community, they like the concept of paying for increased time and increased service without any detrimental or negative impacts on environmental protection. They're willing to pay those additional fees, but that's something we're going to be looking at. And so absolutely paying attention to those other states. That's, again, why we did the analysis over the last 5 years and looked at those other states. Hopefully, Representative, that answers your question.
Thank you.
I think a lot of people moving to Florida and a lot of industry moving to Florida. So, Rep. Mears.
Thank you. That's exactly where I was going to start to head down with permit fees and stuff. Certainly general permits, from my experience, are very helpful. It not just reduces agency time for review, but also consultants' time for being able to prepare things. You know, it's another place where we've got workforce shortages, is that, you know, the consultants have got limited time as well, and that adds to project costs. But, you know, in general, a lot of programs, their permit fees do not take care of the cost of running these programs, and they do come from general fees, as we were just discussing. And earlier you'd said that, you know, hopefully, you know, or potentially if we have the problem of too much growth or extra growth greater than the program, it means that the economy is chugging along and there's money, more money coming into the state coffers in that way to pay for the program in a roundabout way. So that's not completely tied together. It seems.
Is there a question coming, Rep. Mears?
It seems a little premature at this point to be looking at, you know, we are looking at general fund dollars to start this off when there is a potential future for either federal support for taking over the federal primacy or a program that would do more to take care of paying for itself. So do you have any comments on that potential timing?
Representative Mears, through the chair, thank you so much for that question. It's absolutely something we're committed to looking at. I will say, first of all, with respect to your statements about GPs versus IPs, general permits versus individual permits, one of the really great things about a general permit is there is a finite amount of responsibilities on both our end as well as the project, the permittees, that you have to follow these certain stipulations. And if you don't meet them, you can always go for an IP. You can always go for an individual permit. But if you want to fall under that, you have to meet those minimum requirements. And so that's a great opportunity to maximize, especially with the issues that you raised, those opportunities. With respect to putting the cart before the horse on a funding perspective, I think, you know, we've gotten a lot of folks that have come to us, from the home builders to the Associated General Contractors, the folks that work for the Resource Development Council, in the mining industry, and others, who want the state to have this oversight. They are willing to pay the permit fees, or at least some permit fees, and we need to have that discussion with them. We don't know what they're going to be. We don't want to run folks out of business. We want to have an open and transparent discussion with them. We also think that there is opportunity for general fund dollars to help continue to support this program, at a minimum, to support us writing the application to do it. But we're committed to having that conversation with them. We don't want to run folks out of business or scare them away from developing projects in Alaska because of fees, which is why we need to have that conversation with them. And concurrently, we really truly believe, and the delegation agrees, there should be some federal support for this, which will subsidize that cost. We are taking on the responsibilities of the federal government for this. They should be, like I said, showing us a little love. Those are things we'll continue to pursue, and those conversations with the regulated community are ones that are going to be in open, transparent process, and obviously, legislative input will be important as well. But I think that is something that once we get the program on board, they're going to be willing to have those conversations with us.
Okay, I'm losing people here like crazy. Maybe we should finish up these three slides if possible. Okay, thank you.
So the question, what did the feasibility study recommend? I'm going to read to you a quote. This is located on page 45 of the feasibility study, and it reads, I quote, "Given the state's rights under cooperative federalism, the importance of the natural environment and natural resources to the people and economy of Alaska, the importance of wetland permitting in Alaska, and the potential for influencing resource protection and development policies, the recommended course of action is for the state of Alaska to assume the 404 program over assumable WOTUS." So what's the next step? Next step would be to obtain funding and hire staff. So we'll prepare the application, submit it to EPA in the first quarter of 2025, and we anticipate program approval mid to late 2025. And with that, I'll open it up for questions.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes, sir.
I just have something that I want to make sure that we didn't include on a slide, but it's such an important component to us assuming this program. We've talked a lot about the business case for taking over the 404 program. I want to talk about what is the root of DEC's mission, protecting human health and the environment. This is the environmental case for this program coming over the state. Right now, as Shannon talked a little bit about, when a project is developed in the state and it impacts wetlands, we have two choices. Even though there's the flexibility with the Corps of Engineers, we can either create new wetlands or we can conserve lands in perpetuity. Alaska has 150 million acres of lands conserved in perpetuity in conservation system units within the state. That's amazing. We have set a very high environmental ethic. In addition, we've only developed 0.1% of our wetlands. Again, a fantastic environmental ethic. When you're talking about trying to, if you're impacting wetlands in a watershed, you want to mitigate those impacts. Putting $7 million, as an example, at CD5 on the North Slope, when they had to do their mitigation, they had to, ConocoPhillips wrote a check for $7 million to a mitigation bank. No one has any clue to this day where that money went. What environmental benefit did that $7 million have? No one knows. Can you imagine if there was Alaska Native Corporation contaminated sites that could have been cleaned up, or honey bucket communities that could have been eliminated, or fish culverts that could have been put in place in that watershed where the environmental impact was going to be occurring, where the wetlands were going to be impacted? That's the type of opportunity that we have, having the flexibility for compensatory mitigation the state of Alaska could have, that DEC could have, if we brought on this program. There would be not only development opportunities, but ecological benefits from the mitigation projects that we will be encouraging folks to do if these projects go forward. That is one of the things that I think is so important when you're talking about state assuming this program. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Are there any other questions on this subject? Rep. Mears.
Perhaps it's a little premature through the chair with the governor's supplemental or amendments coming out about what the request for the funding for the next year is to work on. I assume it's the application for primacy.
Through the chair, Representative Mears, it's exactly that. We've got permission from the GLOW for us to say the number that obviously we'll be seeing on Wednesday. It will be the 28 positions and the $4.9 million for us to pursue the efforts for the application for primacy.
Follow up.
So solid waste is my expertise, so I'm familiar with that program there. And why so many more people working on the application here than in that effort?
Through the chair, Representative Mears, I think it's a more complex program. I think that there's more activities that occur within the 404 dredge and fill program than you see with the RCRA program. The RCRA program had six individuals. What's fascinating about that is the EPA had one half of one position dedicated to RCRA in the state of Alaska. That person was located in Seattle. When we started putting our application in this past year, we said we were going to put six in, they told us they didn't think that was enough. So they had one half of one position. We had six. It shouldn't surprise anyone, but the 404 program, obviously, with the work that we're going to take over for the Corps of Engineers and the work that they're going to be maintaining, We believe 28 positions this year, growing to 32 the following year, is the right number for us. And obviously, we don't anticipate it, but if there are additional needs in the future, we'll come back to the legislature and ask.
Through the chair, Shannon Miller, for the record, just as a point of clarification, we took on RCRA C, so that is the hazardous material. And I just wanted to make that clarification because that is a little bit different than the landfill RCRA.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions for the DEC team? All right. I'd like to say thank you to the DEC staff and commissioner for making the trip down to see us today. I think this is a good opportunity for the state to assert more control over the development of our resources. I'm looking forward to hearing more about your progress going forward. That concludes today's agenda. Our next meeting is on Wednesday, February 15th, immediately following the DNR Finance Committee. In addition to the announced schedule, we may also take up the sectional analysis and fiscal note for HB 50, the carbon sequestration bill. Members, please note that I also intend to look to the will of the committee on HDR 6, which is the Willow resolution at Friday's meeting. So trying to give you a little notice on what could happen this week. Please submit any amendments to my office by 5 o'clock on Thursday. Is there any other business? Seeing none, this meeting is adjourned at 2:11 p.m.